Following is a presentation of Grace Covenant Baptist Church, West Monroe, Louisiana.
Okay, Rudy is off at a wedding, so I'm pinch hitting for him this morning. We're still in the 11th chapter of Romans. And if you remember, the overall theme of this section of Romans is God's sovereignty. So we're gonna stay in that general theme. Our primary text this morning is going to be verses 7 through 16. But I want to go back and kind of review verses 1 through 6 to give us context for what we're going to be talking about a little later on. Paul transitions from chapter 10 into chapter 11 with a repeated rhetorical question. If you look back in chapter 10 at verse 18, he says, "But I ask," and then he goes on with his discussion. Well, he uses that same device in chapter 11. To begin chapter 11 in verse 1, he says, "I ask then," or the literal translation is, "Therefore I say." And the question he asked is, did God reject his people? And the Greek construction here would lead to a negative response. The response would go something like, "God did not reject his people, did he?" And then that in itself is reinforced with Paul's characteristic negative response by no means. He says, verse 1, "I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means." And then he starts a defense of his premise. The first defense he uses is he talks about himself. He uses himself as his first proof that he had responded to Christ and he had received God's righteousness. Yet at the same time, he was an Israelite. And it's interesting that he uses, he says not only is he an Israelite, but he is from the tribe of Benjamin. Now that has significance because the tribe of Benjamin was small, but it was a significant tribe in Israel. In fact, Saul, who was Israel's first king, came from the tribe of Benjamin. So the sense here is Paul saying that if God can save me, then he can save other Jews. I'm going to talk about a lot of cross-references this morning. We're not going to have time to run most of them. I'll try to go slow enough, so if you want to jot them down and run them later, you can. Here we would go to 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. 1 Timothy 1, 15, 16. Paul says there, "The saying is trustworthy and deserving of full acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I, Paul, and the foremost. But I, Paul, received mercy for this reason, that in me as the foremost, Jesus Christ might display his perfect patience as an example to those who were to believe in him to eternal life." So, again, what Paul is saying here is that if God can save me, then he can save other Jews. Then Paul goes on to say, back in Romans, he positively declares that God has not rejected his people. We see that again, 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 22, says, "For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. And we see that same concept in Psalms 94:14. It says, "For the Lord will not forsake his people. He will not abandon his heritage." So Paul is making a very firm statement that no, God is not going to, will not abandon Israel. But if we go back to Romans chapter 11, verse 2, said God has not rejected his people, unqualified statement, has not rejected, but notice the qualifier. What's the qualifier? Yeah, whom he foreknew. So he makes an unqualified statement, and then he qualifies it. We talked last week about foreknowledge, foreknowing. It carries the sense of having a meaningful relationship with. And that goes back to Romans chapter 8, verse 29. So let's flip back there just a minute. Romans 28, verse 29. And we're gonna camp here for a minute because I want to unpack this a little bit as we begin to understand what he's saying. So chapter 8, verse 29. "For those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers." And we could spend an entire hour here. We're going to unpack this and look at several elements of this verse. First of all, believers are those whom God foreknew. Now, this doesn't simply mean that God foreknows what believers will do, but he knows them. Nor does it indicate divine knowledge as merely an awareness of an individual or an acquaintance with an individual. Instead, it carries the sense, as we said earlier, of a meaningful relationship with a person based on God's choice. We find that in Amos chapter 3, verse 2. It says, "You only have I known of all the families of the earth, therefore I will punish you for your iniquities." So it's based on God's choice made in eternity before creation. And we find that in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4. Very familiar, we're all familiar with this one. He chose us in him before the creation of the world. So this eternal choice, this eternal foreknowledge, involves more than simply establishing a relationship between God and believers. Because back in 8:29, it goes on to say that those God foreknew, he also, kind of a conjunctive, he also predestined to what? To be conformed to the likeness of his son. We also see that in 1 John chapter 3, verse 2. So this entire group that's brought into relationship with God in his eternal plan by divine foreknowledge and choice are predestined or predetermined to be conformed to the image of Christ. God determined beforehand that believers' destiny or end item, if you please, would be conformity to the image of Christ. So that by all the believers being made in being made like Christ, which is the ultimate complete sanctification. That's kind of the end item. Christ will be exalted as the firstborn among many believers. The resurrected and glorified Christ will become the head of, so to speak, a new race of humanity, purified from all contact with sin and prepared to live in eternity with Christ. And as the firstborn, he is in the highest position among others. So that's the plan, so to speak. But if you'll also notice that between the beginning and the ending, there are a number of steps. There are three steps. The step of being called. Called first, being justified, being glorified. And it's not in this verse, but we also know that in this entire process, not a single person is lost. One writer put it this way: God completes his plan without slippage. No, nobody gets lost in this. It's also interesting to note in the chapter 8, verse 29, that end item, I'm sorry, it's verse 30. It said, those whom he justified, he also glorifies. We're going to do a little grammar here. Glorified here is in the past tense. So from God's perspective, it's done. It's a done deal. it's so certain that in God's eyes, it's as good as completed. So to be glorified is another way of saying that God's children, the believers, will be conformed to his Son, which is, in a sense, God's ultimate purpose. And no longer will they fall short of the glory of God, which we saw in Romans chapter 3, verse 23. So coming back to our chapter 11, and Paul's argument, God has chosen Israel as his covenant people from eternity past and entered into a relationship with them that will never be destroyed. Jeremiah 31, verse 37. So Paul makes this argument as his first defense. First himself, and then the foreknowledge. Then his second proof, or his second defense that we talked about last week, comes from Israel's history. He talks about Elijah. You know, we saw that Elijah was depressed. He was having a pity party. He's running from Ahab. Actually, he's running from Jezebel. And he makes a he makes a complaint to God, or a petition to God. You know, it's poor me. They've killed all your prophets. Now they're after me. They're going to kill me. I'm the only one left. But notice how Paul responds to that. He doesn't directly confront that, but he says, yeah, that's not exactly true, because God said there are 7,000 prophets left. You're not the only one. God is not limited to one fearful, depressed prophet, that he's reserved for himself a remnant in Israel that numbered 7,000. That's 1 Kings chapter 19. And we see that this preservation of this remnant is a work of God. Now that has implications for what Paul is describing in terms of Israel. The remnant that is preserved is by God's choice. So after after Paul uses this historical illustration, he draws a conclusion for his day. Verse 5. It says, so too at the present time, that's Paul's present time, there is a remnant, how? Chosen by what? Grace. So Paul is only one of perhaps many in his generation that were elected to faith from the people of Israel. And I think we would be safe to say that in every generation of the church, or in every generation generally, there is a remnant chosen by grace from the Jews, or from or among the Jews. They've been called out from among the Jews. And then Paul goes on to say that this choice is totally God's grace. We see that again in Ephesians chapter 2. And then he again makes the argument about the antithesis between works and grace. We see that in several places. This is in Romans chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, chapter 9, verses 30 to 36, and then here in chapter 11, verses 7 through 10. Then he kind of generalizes some things. He begins to talk about what this remnant chosen by grace out of Israel meant for the people as a whole. Now we've got an ironic situation here, because the Jews were zealous. They zealously sought to be accepted by God on the basis of works, of rituals, of righteousness to the law. So, however, we also see from verse 6, look at verse 6 a minute. Now, you kind of got to read between the lines here. It said, but if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. Now, he's using the grace works argument, but he's also saying something else here. He's saying that while they were zealous for all these rites and rituals, they were not accepted by God. Only the elect were, because of God's sovereign choice by grace. So he's carving out that subset, so to speak, from the general populace. So he said it's in his own time. It continues to now. There's a remnant chosen by grace, verse 5. The remnant, these are the Jewish believers, did not exist because of works they had done, but because they had been selected on the basis of God's own unmerited favor. Again, the grace works mutually exclusive principles. And then there's another concept here, that if the remnant had earned their position by their works, then grace would no longer have been grace. As a remnant chosen by grace, there was absolutely no room for personal merit or meritorious performance. Going back to his historical illustration, there may have been room for condemnation. What's the other word? Commendation of the 7,000 that they were preserved. But in the case of the remnant in Paul's day, there's nothing that they could have done that would have merited their standing before God. Now think about that in terms of Second Temple Judaism. What did Second Temple Judaism teach about how they got their merit? That's not rhetorical. Well, it's works. They got it because they were Jews. They were part of the nation. They were part of God's favor. And Paul is very clearly saying here, hey guys, that is not the case. Okay, we come to verse 7. Now, up to this point, most of us Reformed folks would not have a whole lot of trouble accepting this. This is kind of what we believe. Not kind of what we believe. This is what we believe. This is all in this concept of God's grace and grace, choice by grace, so forth and so on. But we're coming to a section now where there's lots of different opinions about what these verses mean. There's a lot of ink spilled, there's a lot of stuff written, a lot of differences. So we're going to basically stay with what the text says, and then we'll make some general comments about interpretation and meaning. Okay, verse 7. Say, what then? Another rhetorical question. Israel failed to obtain what it was seeking. What was it seeking? Justification, right standing with God, you know, the things that we've been talked about before. And he reiterates, the elect obtained it, but, contrast, the rest were hardened. Now, hardening here, and just generally, hardening also has a component of disobedience. One author says, disobedience never leaves a person in the same condition. Now think about that. Disobedience never leaves a person where they started. For the believer, obedience draws us into a more intimate relationship with Christ. But for the believer and the non-believer, disobedience separates and hardens. So the portion of Israel who were not elect, who were not called, who were not believing, were being separated and hardened. This author goes on and said, the tragic aspect of hardening is that disobedient people are increasingly unable to grasp the serious nature of their spiritual apostasy. So as the disobedience continues and increases, then the hardening continues and increases to the point where they're unable to understand the seriousness of what they're doing. Which, again, is part of what that group of Israel was doing at that point. Then Paul goes on to describe several Old Testament passages that illustrate this. These come from Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 4, and Isaiah chapter 29, verse 10. The general concept is that God brought them a spirit of numbness. And he goes on specifically to say that their eyes could not see, their ears could not hear. We see that in Romans 11:8. And their failure to trust resulted in a state of spiritual insensitivity. It's described as a torpor or a stupor. And then Paul says that's going on from then until now. It's going on to the present time. And I would argue that it goes on until our present time. this author says, spiritual hardening is a terminal disorder for which, in its advanced stages, there is no remedy. And then Paul gives us these quotations, both from Deuteronomy and Isaiah. And this is interesting. It has the sense of being stung by an insect, which produces this stupor. So, I know some insects hurt pretty bad. I don't know one that might induce that kind of, but it's that kind of corresponding thought. Produces blindness, deafness, insensitivity. And then the second quotation he uses here is from Psalm 69:20, verse 22. And it's almost a prediction. It predicts that the very things that should have been the source of nourishment or blessing to Israel, because it's the symbol of the table, which should have been symbolic of blessings from God, which would have then led them to Christ. We see that in Galatians chapter 3, verse 24. That what should have been a positive thing, what should have been a blessing, had in fact become a stumbling block. And it's described as a snare, as a trap, as God's judgment or retribution on them. And then because they refused to receive God's truth, their backs would be bent under the weight of guilt and punishment forever. Think about that. Punishment forever for the non-elect. So, I mean, Paul's making a really pretty heavy theological case here. And we could spend lots of time with this, so we just kind of hit the top of the peak of the rise, so to speak. Then we come to verse 11, after he gets through with his Old Testament examples in 9 and 10. And verse 11, again, it's a rhetorical question. He says, so I ask, did they stumble in order that they might fall? Has Israel stumbled so that they're irretrievable? Were they beyond recovery? And again, he says, you know, no, by no means, not at all. By no means is the actual translation here. And then he gives a kind of a contrast. It says, rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. So, they haven't stumbled irretrievably, but in fact, because of their rejection of the gospel, salvation has gone out to the Gentiles. Acts 14, verses 3 through 6. And this, in turn, would make Israel envious and incite them to do what the Gentiles had done. So it's true that Israel stumbled. But God, who is working all things together according to his plans and according to good, which we saw in chapter 8, verse 28, has decreed that the result of their transgression would ultimately provide the incentive for their return. If Israel's false step had brought enrichment to the world, and their defeat had provided to be such a benefit for the Gentiles, just think about how would be the result of their complete restoration. I'm seeing some consternation. Riches for the world speaks to the abundant benefits that accompany adoption into God's family. Israel's loss refers to all that they had sacrificed by their obstinate refusal to accept God's way of faith. Israel's fullness refers to the time of their full restoration, which we will deal with more fully when we get to verse 25 and following. So there's another kind of subset here, verses 13 through 16. Paul's been talking a lot about Israel's condition, and that's the major theme since the beginning of chapter 9. But we see in verse 13 that he's talking specifically to the Gentiles. Talking specifically to the Gentile believers. And throughout this entire section, previous to this, he talked about his Jewish kinsmen in the third person. Now he begins to talk to his Gentile readers in the second person. So there's a shift grammatically. And he's reminding, I think there's an applicational point here, he's reminding his Gentile readers, first of all, that it's to him that he's talking. And he is warning them not to presume on their position, as we'll see later on, as the wild branch that had been grafted into the historic tree of Jewish origin. I think there's an applicational point for us to be careful with how we think about, how we relate to, how we respond to the Jews. Believing, and this would get me in trouble, and non-believing. That we can't become too arrogant with our position. We can't become too arrogant with the proposition that the church has replaced Israel. Then Paul goes on to talk about he is the apostle to the Gentiles. He put a lot of stress on that. And then he talks about that his hope is that he might stir up this envy in his countrymen, that he might save some. That's in verse 14. Now, look back at verse 12. It says, now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? That seems to be pretty positive. That seems to be pretty inclusive. But then down in 15, he says, he says it may save some. 14. In order that somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous, that thus some say some. So there seems to be something a little contradictory between those two verses. In fact, they are parallel, but on the surface it seems to be somewhat contradictory. So we got to do another little grammar thing here. I know some of y'all hate grammar. The final clause in verse 12 contains no verb. In verse 15, there are verbs. So we may not be too off base to read 15 as how much greater riches would their fullness bring. rather than the English rendering, how much greater riches will their fullness bring? It's just a possible thought. This would be in keeping with verse 23, which we're not to yet, but in verse 23, which says the Jews will be grafted back into the tree if, first class conditional, they do not persist in unbelief. So, again, just something to think about. We do see that verse 15 parallels verse 12. If the rejection of Israel led to reconciliation for the world, what would their acceptance mean, full acceptance, what would their acceptance mean but life from the dead? So there's a parallelism there. As I said, there's lots of different ideas, there's lots of different opinions, there's lots of different writing about the meaning of this section. They seem to fall into three basic categories. One is that there will be an unprecedented spiritual awakening in the world. The second is the consummation of redemption at the resurrection of the dead. That gets into all the resurrections in Revelation, the first resurrection, the second resurrection. And then the third one, they take this as a completely figurative expression describing the conversion of the Jews. Now, each has its adherents, each has its volumes, but it seems that what Paul is talking about here is that there will be a great spiritual awakening of Israel that takes place at the end of human history. One writer says, the acceptance of the gospel by the Jewish people will mean for them the passage from a status of death to life. So, if we follow this parallelism between 12 and 15, then life from dead essentially is saying the same thing as their fullness. That is the full quota of the Jews. So for Israel to turn from their unbelief and embrace the gospel of salvation by faith could well be described as a resurrection. Again, I'm not making any definitive statements. I'm saying these are possibilities. This is what the text says. You know, how we read that, how we interpret that. Sometime over coffee, I'll tell you my personal belief. But there are many different ways to interpret this. Okay, that brings us to chapter 16. To verse 16, I'm gonna stop with this one because this seems to kind of conclude this pericope and it starts the next. And he starts with another example, another quote. This is from Numbers 15, verses 17 through 21, and it describes an offering made from the first grain harvested in ground. It's a cake presented to the Lord, and it consecrates the rest of the batch. So Paul writes that if the dough offered its first fruits was holy, then the entire batch was holy. This is a metaphor, obviously. The dough represents the Jewish believers who had accepted Christ as the remnant described in verse 5. And the whole batch, now notice, the whole batch is not the rest of the nation of Israel. The whole batch would be those who would come to believe. And then there's a little bit, a different take with the tree. We're going to talk As we progress in this chapter, we're going to talk a lot about trees and grafting and wild olive trees and native olive trees, maybe some pomegranate trees, I don't know. This is the metaphor changes to a tree with its branches, and the sense is that if the root is holy, so are the branches. In this case, the root represents the patriarchs, especially Abraham, and the branches represent the nation that follows. Now, this would seem to indicate the nation generally, which we've kind of already seen is maybe not necessarily true. So the point is that if the patriarchs were holy, and they were, so also were the Jewish people. And here's the caveat. Only in the sense that the positive effects of the patriarchs reached to them. It's not dealing with salvation. So we might sum up this section. I think we can safely sum up this section that God's rejection of the Jewish nation was neither complete. We see that in verses 1 through 10. Nor is it final, verses 11 through 24. It's not a complete rejection, and whatever this is that's going to happen within his sovereignty is not finished. There's more to come. So. And with that, I will stop. I hate to ask for thoughts or questions, but are thoughts, questions, comments?
Thank you.